business to biology, Professor Kerry Landman has taken her love for applied mathematics and made a huge impact. For some 40 years, she has devoted her career to cross-disciplinary research to help solve a wide range of problems.
I get a real buzz from finding out about new things, so I did that in mathematics by working interdisciplinary.
In 2014, Kerry was awarded the ANZIAM Medal, the premier medal of the Australia and New Zealand Industrial and Applied Mathematics Society. In 2019, the Australian Academy of Science named her a Fellow of the Academy. In this podcast, Kerry talks about her career in applied mathematics, some of the people who have impacted her life over the years, and the twists and turns when it comes to what her research has focused on.
Basically, that seminar changed my research life for the next 15 years.
In 2007, Kerry became the first female mathematics professor at the University of Melbourne. Now, recently retired from the university, she's not slowing down. Kerry talks about her newfound focus in life.
I've been able to combine my interest in education and also my interest in the arts.
We're so excited to have such a distinguished mathematician on our podcast, and we know you'll enjoy hearing what Professor Kerry Landman has to say. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily Duane. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics, and the people involved. You can learn more about what the centre does by visiting our website, acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host for this episode is ACEMS Director Peter Taylor, a Redmond Barry Distinguished Professor in the School of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Melbourne.
So welcome everybody. I'm sitting here this afternoon talking over Zoom to Kerry Landman, who's a colleague of mine at the University of Melbourne. Kerry's a very distinguished Australian applied mathematician, and we're going to talk about some of the experiences she's had down the years. So Kerry, welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter.
So I'm going to start off with a question I ask a lot of people when I get the chance to interview them on a podcast, which is, can you tell me about the time that you first thought that you might have a career in mathematics?
I went to an all-girls school, and maths was always my favourite subject, and that was reflected in my marks. It just always seemed natural to continue studying maths, the subject I loved best. My parents never questioned me about it, and I went to the University of Melbourne, did a science degree majoring in mathematics. My honours project in functional analysis was my first experience in what it might be like to do research. You might think it's odd, Peter, to say this, but I don't think I really questioned going on to do a PhD. It just seemed natural to continue along that path. I also discovered much later that my mother and grandmother loved maths too. And my brother has a PhD in applied mathematics, so maybe it's in our genes.
So Kerry, going back to school then, there must have been a time where you were sitting in school thinking, yeah, maths is for me. And when you, for instance, had to decide what to do at university, you already knew you wanted to make maths your main subject. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. But when I went to school, the class sizes in maths and physics were very small, around six or so. And when I got to university, I met students who were, you know, very keen and smart math students. And they'd all been exposed to advanced extracurricular mathematics. And I must say I felt a little bit envious. I'd never met students like that before. My school has now changed quite a lot since then. But maybe when I'm sitting back 50 years later, it made very little difference in the end.
So Kerry, you've talked about how you went to university and you sort of were quite sure that you wanted to make mathematics your main subjects. So it must have been back in school where you got that view. Were there any mentors in that period of your life that sort of helped you develop that ambition?
Not really, because I had not really in year 11 and 12. I had a very good maths teacher in grade 10, and I remember a maths teacher from earlier time too. But I just love learning mathematics and solving problems, and often I've just worked on my own. As I said, there were very small class sizes, and there were only two of us in the class that really did well at maths.
Okay. You went to university. University of Melbourne it was, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And so what happened? How did your maths career go there? I mean, you said you sort of felt like the next step to honours and a PhD was natural, but can you sort of give us some idea of how you were feeling about things back then?
Yes, I was quite strategic about choosing a PhD topic. Of course, I chose an area that interested me, but I also thought it was very important to choose a good supervisor. And it turns out, this is the advice I've given many times, I did a PhD in bifurcation theory with Professor Simon Rosenblatt. And this is an area of analysis that sits between pure and applied mathematics. I knew I wanted to do a postdoc overseas, and I got a 2-year position in the Applied Mathematics Department at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. So obviously that decided I was going to become an applied mathematician.
So if listeners don't know, MIT is one of the very best technological universities in the world. In fact, it's one of the very best universities in the world, period. So Kerry, it must have been quite exciting to go there.
It was very exciting and rather daunting. I'd never met so many people from overseas and wonderful postdocs, PhD students, and so many visitors from all around the world. But I joined Professor Harvey Greenspan's group, and Harvey was well known for his work on fluid mechanics. But he'd become interested in biology and had been working with a pediatric oncologist called Dr. Judah Folkman. And their experiments and models on tumour growth dynamics are now seminal and have been cited thousands of times. And my project concerned red blood cells, which can change shape in different environments. And my research explained these changes in terms of fluid mechanics. So this was my first experience of mathematical mock biology. And for some of the listeners, they will have heard this name before, but it was also where I heard James Murray give a talk, How Did Leopards Get Their Spots? And James Murray is a Scottish mathematician who wrote the 2-volume Bible on mathematical biology.
That's interesting, because I know that you're very well known for your contributions to mathematical biology, but I was under the impression they occurred mainly later on in your career. But now it's news to me that you actually started off in your postdoc working on mathematical biology. It's very interesting.
Yes, but you are correct that most of my last 15 years of my career I worked on mathematical biology, but the first experience at MIT was a singular event almost.
Right.
And so the MIT position was a 2-year instructorship, and I was doing research and teaching at the same time, but I wasn't really sure I wanted to be an academic. But I knew I wanted to stay in the United States. So I talked to Harvey, who was a great mentor, and he suggested I contact Dr. David Rosenblum at the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and he was establishing a new group. So this opportunity arose and I took it. And you'll hear that my career had many twists and turns, and I've never had a grand plan. So I moved from Boston to Washington, and that appointment was only for 1 year because I was not a US national. And my title on my US visa was expert, and I just thought that was just wonderful. Our group at the Environmental Protection Agency were investigating indoor pollution caused by radon gas, which enters homes. And radon is produced through radioactive decay of uranium, and it's naturally occurring in rocks. It's very interesting that it's estimated that radon causes 10% of lung cancers in the United States. So I developed a model for the transport of radon gas into homes. But as I said, it was a one-year position, and I actually realised that I missed teaching. So then I applied for academic positions in the United States, and I became an assistant professor in the maths department at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And I just continued to extend some of the MIT work and my EPA work.
Okay, so how long were you at Southern Methodist?
3 years.
Right. So that's what, 6 or 7 years in the US, if I'm adding it up correctly, is it?
Six,
right. And then what happened?
Well, after 5 years in the United States, I knew I wanted to return to Australia. But there were no openings at universities at that stage, and I became a consultant at CyroMath, which was partly owned by CSIRO. And CSIRO wanted to establish a mathematics and industry study group. And Professors John and Hilary Ockenden had been running study groups in Oxford University for many years. So CSIRO invited the Ockendens to Melbourne, and I worked with the Ockendens and CSIRO to establish the first study group. The Ockendens really gave me my education in industrial mathematics. They were wonderful role models. I was always amazed at how they talked about mathematics with people that knew no mathematics at all. And they were just fantastic at explaining how mathematical expertise can help solve industrial problems. So my first work with the Ockendens was setting up meetings with industry and business, and we were not looking for equations to solve, but we were looking for meaty projects. For example, a process that industry wanted to understand or improve.
Kerry, I first met you through the Mass and Industry Study Group, or at least heard of your contribution, because back in the 1990s, you were very well known for running that group. But you're not talking about then, are you? You're talking about much earlier.
Talking about 10 years earlier.
Right. I didn't know you were involved in the Mass and Industry Study Group back then.
Oh, well, that's good to know something new.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, I was in 1984. So this was the first study group, and it was held at University of Melbourne. And after that, it went to different universities. But I think maybe we should talk about what a study group is.
Yeah, sure. The listeners, of course, will be quite interested in that, I think.
So it's a problem-solving workshop that brings mathematicians together to work with industry and business on specific projects. And you put maths people together with industry people for a week, and somehow magic happens. Every participant chooses what problems they want to work on, but some amazing people make contributions to multiple problems. I think mathematicians are very good at asking the industry representatives probing questions. And sometimes these questions appear to be dumb. But these questions really challenge their long-held beliefs and assumptions. And you really need to ask a lot of questions to identify the essential mechanisms that you might put into a model.
So just so the listeners might get some idea of what you're talking about in more detail, can you maybe give us a couple of example projects and maybe examples of the sort of thing you've been talking about where having a mathematician ask questions makes a difference?
Yes, that'd be great. So I'll give you an example of a problem that came from Solar Optical that makes plastic spectacle lenses. Plastic lenses are often treated with a scratch-resistant coating, but the coating thickness can vary, and this degrades the quality of the lenses. So at MISG, we developed a mathematical model that identified the factors that contribute to these variations. We also derived an expression showing exactly how the draw speed should be varied to ensure an even coating. And for this problem, the team even devised an experiment to see the defects. They'd take a lens and pull it out vertically from a bowl of milk. A second example is from Uncle Toby's, who make Vitabrits. So the most time-consuming stage in making Vitabrits involves cooking single grains of wheat in large steamers. In order to have the best taste, the grains have to be cooked to a point of starch gelatinization, but no longer. Otherwise, your breakfast cereal will go soggy. Uncle Toby's wanted to speed up the cooking process and ensure that the grains were evenly cooked. So we built models to predict the moisture content and temperature inside the grain during the steaming process. This actually was the beginning of a long-term project to optimize the performance of the bulk steamers. And I was involved in that for a number of years. And there, besides those sort of industrial problems, and I could rattle off a lot of them, there are also problems in optimization and logistics. So for example, one came from Australian Paper, which MISG devised a model which would allow the mills to maximise delivery to customer stores and minimise paper reel handling. And there was one from the Department of Health on managing hospital surgery waiting lists and theatre scheduling, and many, many more.
So, Kerry, you mentioned that sometimes mathematicians asking questions, or even dumb questions, changes the insight of the industry part into a problem. So you've talked about a few different types of problems that MISG looked at, but is there one where, can you give me an example of something where that happened, where some mathematician asked a question and the industry partner sort of, it changed the way they looked at things?
Oh, I could do that from the Uncle Toby's project, because they always thought it took much longer for the heat to get into a grain than for the moisture. And a fairly simple calculation and just some probing questions established that that was not the case.
So they thought that something was true about their process, and the mathematicians made them realise it wasn't true. Is that fair enough?
That is correct.
Wow.
And there are multiple examples.
Okay. And is it, does that happen because the mathematician's gone away and done some calculations and really come back with a complete understanding? Or is it because the mathematician's just sometimes willing to put themselves out there and ask questions, which might not even be sensible, but it gets people thinking?
Well, there are examples in both cases, but for the Uncle Toby's project, once you know what the diffusion rates for moisture and heat are in that circumstances, you can do a calculation, a back of the envelope calculation for the time. And many other things with the probing questions that you just keep asking, why do you believe that? Why do you believe that? And it turns out that they don't actually have the evidence. They've just always been told that. They've inherited it.
Right. That's the MISG. Getting back to the story, you're working for CyroMath and CSIRO and organising the MISG back in the early 80s. But when I knew that you had organised the MISG, you were at the University of Melbourne as a staff member. So what happened in between?
Well, after the first MISG, I was still at CyroMath and I had to find my own consulting work. And it wasn't easy to find clients, but there's one major project I would like to tell you about because it's something that everybody can relate to. And it was a project brought by Trico, and they design and manufacture windscreen wiper blades. And they wanted me to predict the performance of their designs before they manufacture them. And I developed models and software that was used by Trico in Australia and the UK and the USA. And I found that very rewarding. But at CyroMath and at the Environmental Protection Agency, I was the only mathematician. Everybody else was a statistician. And I really missed having applied mathematicians as colleagues. So I was ready to have an academic career in Australia, and a lectureship in the Department of Maths and Stats at the University of Melbourne was advertised. And that's how I returned to the University of Melbourne 8 years after I'd completed my PhD there.
Okay. So you became a staff member in the same place. Were there any of the people that taught you still around?
Oh, yes, indeed, there were. Mm-hmm.
I had a similar experience. I think it can be quite interesting that people have, you know, you're sitting in a lecture theatre looking up at some amazing person in front of you, and then they become your colleagues. So how did you feel? How did you fit into the department at that time?
I enjoyed it, but in the applied maths group, that was quite changed. And I really joined the colloid science group. But I enjoyed seeing my old colleagues. It was, you know, talking to people and you still call them professor and you wouldn't call them by their first name. So it took some while to get used to it, but it was fairly natural. I was older and more mature.
When you got back in the department in the early 90s, what did you do? What was your basic day like?
Well, I taught engineering maths often, but I also worked in solid liquid separation for many years with Professor Lee White, who was another mathematician, and with chemists and chemical engineers at the University of Melbourne. And we applied our models to a variety of industrial thickening and filtration processes that were used in the mining industry. For example, we worked on red mud waste slurries for the bauxite industry. The models provided designs to optimise the performance of these methods. The models also identified key material parameters, and we provided methods to measure them in the lab, which were done by the chemical engineers at the University of Melbourne. But then we need to revisit now the MISG.
Okay, this being like 8 years later or 10 years later from when you first got involved.
Indeed, because CSIRO had been running them for the last 10 years at different universities, and in 1993 it was held at the University of Melbourne. And there CSIRO announced that they wanted a university to take full responsibility of the future study groups. The head of my department was Professor Tony Gutman. He put his hand up and said, "Yes, we'll do it for 4 years." And I think about an hour later, he asked me to be the director. So that's how I've became involved with the Maths and Industry Study Group again.
And was it different being the director than when you first got involved?
Very much, because I wasn't director last time. I wasn't responsible. And also, I found it quite daunting in the beginning because I was cold calling businesses and marketing mathematics. But it got easier as the years went by. The first year was the hardest because I was sort of starting from scratch. But I really realised that I'd learnt a lot from the Ockendens 10 years earlier. And every year we got 8 projects and over 150 mathematicians, including students, came from Australia and New Zealand. And all the projects I talked about before came during this period.
Okay.
So can I just say the MISG still exists and has been going for about 35 years and it moves between universities every few years.
Yes, and I know through my own involvement with the Australian applied mathematics scene that it's a big job to run it and that it is hard to find the projects, but that the people who go there think it's incredibly valuable and it sometimes changes where their careers go. So obviously you had a big influence on the way that developed. If you hadn't been there, you know, picking it up when CSIRO decided they didn't want to organise it anymore, then it might have stopped. So that I think has been a pretty great contribution. And I was just reflecting when you were talking about the problems you were working on, even here in the university, that there's still industrial problems, bauxite slurry, and, you know, it's still going and talking to people outside the mathematical sciences community, often people in industry, about how mathematical modelling can help them. Would that be a fair way to summarise, to unify all the things you've been talking about so far?
Yes, perfect.
Right. So let's move on then, because I remember when I first turned up in the Department of mathematics and statistics in Melbourne was in the early 2000s. And by that stage, you weren't working so much on industrial mathematics problems anymore. You'd started working again on mathematical biology. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Yes, I did continue working on industrial problems, but I was ready for a change around the early 2000s. And in 2001, Don Newgreen, who's a developmental biologist at Murdoch Children's Research Institute, he gave a seminar in our department. And he thought that a mathematical model might help him answer his questions. So basically, that seminar changed my research life for the next 15 years. It had many intriguing and novel features that I'd never encountered before, and others that I'd had. I found it very exciting. But it was the first time I'd actually collaborated with an experimental biologist, developing models and designing experiments for Don's group. I became completely devoted to working in developmental biology, continued to work with Don's group and other groups. And I consider these 15 years to be the most rewarding of my research life.
And you developed a group of your own. I know that you had a group of fantastic students way back in those times that you worked in various problems, not only Don's problems, but other problems in mathematical biology. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit more detail about some of the problems that your team looked at?
Yeah, I'd love to tell you about the problem with Don, because that was the one I'd worked on for the longest. So he worked on the second brain, which is the nickname for the nervous system of our gut. And it's a complex network of neurons that controls all gut functions. During vertebrate development, a small group of cells called neural crest cells, they move and populate to colonize the whole gut wall from the stomach to the anal end. There's a birth defect, which is relatively common, called Hirschsprung's disease. It occurs when the neural crest cells don't reach the anal end. This means that there's no nervous system in the last part of the gut and no peristaltic contractions. This is potentially fatal unless it's treated surgically. So Don had some big questions he wanted to answer. What mechanisms drive normal development? And what mechanism fails in Hirschsprung's disease? So we spent a lot of time trying to work out what the most important processes are, and during the process, the neural crest cells move and they massively increase in number through cell proliferation. And simultaneously, because it's all happening in a growing embryo, the gut tube grows dramatically in length. So the first project we looked at was that there were four competing hypotheses of the colonization process. And by investigating the cell interactions in different regions in the wave, our modeling predicted one of them. And we designed new experiments, which Don did, which confirmed our predictions. So this is another example of long-held beliefs, because Hirschsprung's disease has always been thought to be a migration defect, that the cells weren't moving properly. And now as a result of this work in modelling and with experiments, the Hirschsprung's disease is regarded primarily as a cell proliferation defect. But we actually modelled over many years many different aspects of this development process. And it resulted in many unexpected features which have been verified in the lab. The models explained many non-intuitive observations, and the modelling uncovered emergent behaviour which we called superstars, which were confirmed by experiments. This provided a new perspective on the development of the nervous system, and this is the work I am proudest of.
So, sorry, Kerry, what's a superstar?
A superstar is a cell which contributes a large number of progeny to the final population. It is not a cell that has a greater proliferative ability. It is a cell which has been able to produce more progeny because of stochastic competition for space and resources. So most of the starting cells actually produce very few progeny, and a few of them produce a large number of progeny. And originally, when Don was doing experiments, he would count the progeny of individual starting cells and find very few, but the whole of the gut was filled with cells. So none of this made sense to him. He thought all the experiments were faulty, but that's exactly how it should be.
Okay, I can see some parallels there in stuff I've done even about, you know, progeny of human beings, that quite a lot of us are descended from only a few people. So I guess it's a similar phenomenon.
And the surprising thing about this is that you can show that it's not because these cells are super proliferative.
They're just lucky.
They're just lucky. What has luck got to do with it? I think we've got a paper titled that.
Right. Okay. I have heard that giving papers good titles is a good thing to do if you want people to read them. So you obviously did that one.
So I would like to say that this work was done by a lot of postdocs and postgraduate students, and they really were a key to the success of the project.
Okay, and I do want to ask you about that, because I think one of the things that I know you're very, very good at is looking after a team of students and sort of nurturing them and helping them develop. And I noticed that with your PhD students of that time. So I guess they haven't all gone on to be experts in mathematical biology, but can you tell me a little bit what has happened to the people who were working with you back in the 2000s?
Yes. Most of the students who did PhD didn't do it because they wanted to be academics. They did a PhD because they wanted to continue pursuing their love of maths. So many of the PhD students are actually in consulting companies or other types of organisations, like the Boston Consulting Group or Cancer Council of Australia, and they're working as data scientists or data analysts. But of the PhD students, three of them do have academic positions in Australia. And for the postdocs, several of them have very successful academic careers, and they're now professors or associate professors.
So, Kerry, you've talked about the students who are in your group, but groups at universities, research groups, are often bigger than that. So, and you've mentioned you had a collaborator, Don Newgreen, from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, but did you have any other collaborators, say, in the School of Maths and Stats that you want to talk about as well?
Oh, thanks, Peter, because I'd really want to talk about Professor Barry Hughes. So he was a colleague of mine, and we had offices next to each other for many years. And for the last 10 years, we co-supervised about 15 postgraduate students and several postdocs. And this was very important. I think we were a great team in mentoring our group. Because most of our work was interdisciplinary, everybody learned how to communicate with people in other disciplines. And they were able to tailor their talks to biological audiences or maths audiences and to present them at conferences. And most of our students collaborated with overseas researchers and travelled overseas. So they gained many generic skills needed to build a successful career, and Barry and I formed a really good partnership there, I think.
Okay, and I might observe that, I mean, it's starting to be much more common these days, but when you guys started doing that, that wasn't completely a common thing to do in the mathematical sciences, was it? To run a sort of team and have joint supervision and things like that. I mean, that was relatively novel back then, wasn't it?
I think that's correct. But this was a stage, I'd been working mostly in partial differential equations, and Barry works in random processes. And we could see that there was an alignment of those two areas for working in mathematical biology. So I started talking to him about the applications I was interested in. And so we worked together on some mathematical biology problems, some coming from the Howard Florey Institute, and other places, and we also did quite a lot of theoretical work together.
I have to say, one of the reasons that I really wanted to talk to you for the random sample was because in two previous episodes of the random sample, one where I was talking to James McCaw and another one where the interviewee was Matt Simpson, both of them, completely unprompted, mentioned that they regarded you as an important mentor for them during their careers. And I'm always interested in this. I'm always interested in how mentoring helps and how you know, maybe one person can make a difference. And they both said that you're a person who made a difference to them. So I'm going to ask you, I hope it's not going to embarrass you too much, a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about, say, start with James? How did you meet him, and how do you think you had such an influence on his career?
Well, I remember when I listened to the James McCaw podcast, I was really quite surprised because I had no idea. And I used to teach a third year subject called partial differential equations. And of course, there was a lot of opportunity to do, you know, to talk about modelling. And so I used to throw in examples of the things that I've worked on, physical problems I've worked on, industry problems, and to show them how important learning partial differential equations were. And James was in my class, and I can only think that had an effect that I had no idea about.
Okay, and I know that your relationship with Matt Simpson was a little bit closer because he did actually work for you as a postdoctoral fellow, didn't he?
Yes, he did. In 2003, Don and I received our first research grant and we advertised for a postdoc in mathematical biology. An essential criteria was a PhD in maths, physics, or the equivalent. Matt Simpson had just completed his PhD in engineering at the University of Western Australia, and I received an email from him asking whether I considered his degree to be equivalent. Well, his PhD involved numerics and modelling in groundwater transport. I didn't hesitate to tell him, yes, his degree was equivalent. With his mathematical experience, I knew his expertise could be applied to another area. I've done that over my whole career. And the two of us would learn biology together. It was wonderful working with Matt.
And now he has his own group in mathematical biology up at Queensland University of Technology.
Indeed, and he's got a very successful career working still in cell migration and proliferation in different systems. So his postdoc working with Don and myself was his first experience in this area. And of course, since COVID-19, everybody in Australia knows who James McCaw is because of his epidemic modelling for the federal government.
Yes, and I guess something that you and I both know, but it's certainly worth emphasising for the listeners, is that the sort of skills that James uses for that aren't so different to the sort of skills that you used for modelling tumours or radon transport through walls or the sort of things you were talking about, drying of Vitabrits for Uncle Toby's and Matt working on groundwater. They're all not so different. I mean, obviously each problem has its own little special characteristics, but the sort of thinking you need to be able to look at them is pretty much something that you get taught as part of the unity of applied mathematics.
Exactly, Peter. The applications do look quite distinct, but as mathematicians, we identify patterns, similarities and differences between them. The same mathematics can arise in different areas, and that's what's so powerful and beautiful about mathematics.
Okay, and that's probably a good place to stop our discussion of mathematics. But before I let you go, Kerry, I just want to ask what you've got on the go now, because I know that you've formally retired from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Melbourne, but that you've got plenty of things on the go, and do you want to tell us a little bit about what they are?
Yes, that'll be great. But can I first tell you about why I decided to retire?
Yeah, sure. That's obviously part of the story.
It is, because I think a lot of people were rather surprised. I remember going to a retirement party of a colleague, and he said that the last 10 years of his academic life were the best. And when I heard that, I thought that was just wonderful. And I think I've told you that the last 15 years of my research life were the best, so that's what I decided to do. And when I retired, I stopped accepting invitations to talk because I didn't want to talk about old work as I'd stopped doing research. But in the last 5 years, I've been able to combine my interest in education, the arts, and collaborating with people in other disciplines. So I'll tell you about some of the things I'm involved with.
Yeah, sure.
I'm involved with the Robin Boyd Foundation, and Robin Boyd is perhaps Australia's most influential architect. He was passionate about communicating the benefits of good design to the general public. The listeners might know him as the author of the book The Australian Ugliness. The Robin Boyd Foundation is devoted to continuing his legacy. I coordinate the Research and Collections volunteer team. We've been cataloguing everything in the house he designed for his family in the 50s. So it holds Boyd's manuscripts, the furniture he designed, a beautiful Australian art collection, and the family library. During COVID, the volunteers prepared a virtual 3D tour of the house for Open House Melbourne, which we marked up with information we've been researching. It's on the Foundation's website if you're interested. And I've really enjoyed working with a wonderful group of volunteers who are interested in architecture. The other thing I'm doing is I'm on the board of the Institute of Inquiring Minds. And there are many high school students who are hungry to learn and do well in maths, and they'd benefit from tutorials. So the Institute provides free maths mentoring to students who encounter financial disadvantage. Our mentors come as undergraduates, postgrads, postdocs, young professionals and retirees. Pre-COVID, it was all done face-to-face in Melbourne City Centre. But since COVID, it's all gone online and it works well. It's allowed us to increase our reach to regional and interstate students and mentors. So it has great potential to grow. We are seeking funding to expand, and of course we are looking for new mentors. If any listeners are interested, please look online or contact me. The mentors are fantastic, and there's an opportunity for me to mentor the mentors. I've also always gone to many classical music concerts. So post-COVID, I'm looking forward to recommencing programming and presenting training at 3MBS, Melbourne's Community Classical Music Station.
Oh, okay. So, Kerry, the big picture I get of you, and I hope the listeners have got of you as well, is a person who has tremendous skill in mathematics, but a very, very broad range of interests. And even if you're not interested in something back in the past, you've been willing to find out about it and apply your skills. And now we see, since you've formally retired, that you're getting interested in a whole range of things as well. So I think that's possibly one of the things that made you an extremely successful applied mathematician, because you do have a way of communicating with people, getting on top of whatever problem they might have, if it's in an industrial context, and then maybe delivering it back to them in a way that they can understand. And I know that these are all great skills. So just to finish off, is there anything that you might want to say for any aspiring young applied mathematicians out there about things to do or an attitude to have?
My advice is to find opportunities to collaborate with people in other disciplines. You'll be able to contribute to informed decision-making, and you'll have the potential to make a difference. I really believe that applied mathematics is a wonderful way to make a contribution.
Sure, I agree with you on that 100%. So, Kerry, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this afternoon, and I know the listeners will be interested in a lot of the things you've had to say. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed it.
For more information about what Kerry just discussed, the Robin Boyd Foundation and the Institute for Inquiring Minds, head to our webpage for this episode. We have links to the information she was talking about. We also have a link to the Kerry Landman Scholarship, which supports high-achieving mathematics graduates in financial need who demonstrate a passion for education, wish to train as mathematics teachers, and are enrolling in a Master of Teaching Secondary. To get to the page, head to asins.org.au/podcast. Click on episode 35. Also on that page, we have a link to Kerry's featured video after she was named a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Science. Thank you for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes, because we think stories about maths and stats are worth sharing, and we want others to discover that as well. You can learn more about what we do at acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. And you can find us on social media by searching at Ace Math Stats. That's at ACE Math Stats. We'll see you next week with another story from within ACEMS. Bye for now.